Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, August 4th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio today from the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online is Jeff Spillane. Hiya, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Great.
And joining us a little later will be Jim DiArruda of the New Bedford Standard Times and Josh Balling calling in from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll hear from Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner and George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now, a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the islands. Let's start, Jeff, with the discovery of a body earlier this week on a Coast Guard boat in Chatham. This is a sad story that has just kept unfolding. When this report first appeared on Monday, it just seemed unreal that this was a Coast Guard boat on display on a lawn in Chatham. And the Coast Guard discovered this while they were doing a training exercise.
They were, Steve. And this is a very sad ending to a missing persons case that began last October. And as you had mentioned, last Sunday night, as Coast Guard were getting ready to do an exercise, they discovered a decomposed body inside an airtight and watertight compartment in a 44-foot boat that was on display right in front of the Coast Guard Chatham Station. It's a lifeboat that was first launched in 1963. And it appears as if the body, and it was actually finally confirmed yesterday, is that of Matthew Amsler, who was 24 years old from South Chatham, went missing last October 28th. And appears as if he may have gone inside the compartment. If he perhaps wanted to take a nap there, fall asleep, he may have died of lack of oxygen, is from what we hear here. And the story got a little more interesting as the week went along. His father spoke with one of our reporters, Doug Frazier. Father, who was estranged from the family, lives in New Hampshire, said, "You know, I knew he was in there." And he claims that the Coast Guard never really searched the boat, or never searched it thoroughly enough to find his son's body. Coast Guard came back and said, "Yes, we did search the boat." Whether or not they went into that small space is still yet to be determined. A spokesperson for the Coast Guard said it's a very small space, not meant for human accommodation. And it's likely that nobody may have even thought that somebody may have been in there. It was so small. And a spokesperson for the Coast Guard said, you know, sometimes when you don't want to be found, you're not found.
It sounded like the night he went missing was a rainy night in October, and so there was some suspicion that he would be looking for a place to take cover.
Yes, it was heavy rain that night. Also, we should mention that Mr. Amsler did have a history of mental issues and had been known to go off and disappear for a couple of days at a time.
I think his wife didn't even report him missing until some time had gone by.
Right. Yeah. It had been about 24 hours until she realized that something may have been wrong. And yeah, and 9 months later, here he is.
And the Coast Guard, I know a little bit, as they were talking about this compartment in which his body was found, they said that it was not even, at first it sounded, the reports first sounded like he was in the lifeboat compartment in which people could be kept, you know, as they were saved from a shipwreck, and they would be in this basically watertight compartment. But it was not quite that. It was another compartment in the back of that.
Oh, it's another compartment in the back of that, in the stern, very small. And you're right. Initial reports, you thought he was where you would go if you were
found. If you were taking a nap or something.
Right,
yes.
Yeah. And you're buckled in case the boat rolled, you'd be safe. But no, it turns out he was in a very, very small compartment. And I want to say, you know, the hatch was 2x2, and as a spokesperson for the Coast Guard said, it would not be a very comfortable place to be.
Yeah, I think they said it was about 4x8, very small.
Yeah.
And then, but they did say that they thought he would have been able to open that compartment from the inside if he had wanted to.
That's right.
There's no lock on it. The door was airtight. It's not a
It wasn't
lock.
Locked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that maybe he went in and fell asleep and just ran out of oxygen.
Yeah, and his father said that it looked like when they found him, he had his boots off and looked like he may have been trying to take a nap.
A very, very sad story.
Very
there.
Sad, very sad.
Unfolding. Want to turn now to the nuclear Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. Entergy Corporation, the company that runs the power station, has submitted a plan to address problems at the power station.
They have, and this is a story, as we know, has been ongoing. A lot of controversy, a lot of problems with the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. in recent months and years. A lot of issues with plant workers failing to follow procedure, lack of proper maintenance, leadership issues, lack of following through on issues that have been found there. Well, last Friday, the owners of Pilgrim Entergy Corporation filed a 44-page plan to address the safety issues at the plant. They filed it with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. According to the plan, Entergy will beef up employee handbook, take action, what they call an action boards to stress programs and positive reinforcement, they actually said, with employees to thinking of obedience training here, and individual improvement plans for staff and management with the goal of returning Pilgrim to what they call excellent performance status, which right now Pilgrim is one of the three worst performing plants in the country. It's in what they call column four, Steve, which is one step above mandatory shutdown. The Regulatory Commission will now take a look at the plan, issue what they're calling a confirmation action letter, which will require Entergy to make these corrective actions. And that letter should be back to the plant in about 3 or 4 weeks, from what I understand. And speaking with a nuclear expert, a scientist, one of our reporters, Christine Legere, this scientist said, you know, the plant is scheduled for shutdown, now less than 2 years away. It's going to be in June 2019. And he said, you know, 2 years is not enough to get the plant back to what they want to call excellent operating status. And then, you know, some of the opponents, of course, are saying, you know, this is just enough to limp along to 2019.
Or just that they've come out with this long list. And, and I saw one of the opponents saying, well, this is... She called it just a lot of words.
A lot of words.
One of the biggest problems that they've had there is even following through on their own plans to improve and address problems in the past. It's been demonstrated they haven't been able to do that kind of follow through.
So it'll be interesting to see what they can accomplish here in the next 23 months.
I know, not much time, and I think there's a lot of concern about how that company, which has such a demonstrated poor record already, is going to get through the last... less than 2 years now.
Exactly.
The 7-year-old story of wind turbines in the town of Falmouth has entered a new chapter this week. The town got what I guess you could call is good news, but it's nowhere near that simple.
I guess it's the best news they could expect. Two turbines in the town of Falmouth, which has been, as you mentioned, extremely controversial, causing issues with the neighbors and community over the years. One of them, Wind 2, is what it's called out there at the wastewater treatment plant in Falmouth, was ordered shut down permanently by a judge back in June. Which led many in town to think, okay, that's great, but we owe some money to the Massachusetts Clean Water Trust now that we've shut that off. And indeed, the town does owe the trust $4.9 million, which wouldn't have been due had the turbines stayed operational. So the Mass Clean Water Trust this week voted to give the town of Falmouth a break. They said, we will cut that $4.9 million debt that you owe us down to $2.9 million. So they took $2 million off the top and also attached a zero interest rate on it. So the town will be saving about $3 million. You know, obviously, if it kept running, they wouldn't have to pay it back. And the reason the trustees did this was because they said for the 5 years this turbine was running, it did provide energy efficiency, and we're willing to work with the town. They understand it's been a difficult few years here, and we'll work on a schedule that is okay for all parties.
I know that the town, a couple of weeks ago, they said that they were looking at about $12 million to decommission both, or the cost of not running both turbines. So a $2 million forgiveness is something.
It is something, plus the zero interest.
Yeah. This too is we have not seen the last chapter of that.
Not by a long shot.
I want to go to Jim DiAruta of the New Bedford Standard Times. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Steve.
Jim, Michelle Carter, the young woman convicted of involuntary manslaughter and the killing of her friend Conrad Roy III when she sent him texts and phone messages encouraging a suicide effort. Carter faced sentencing yesterday. This has been a long and painful story.
It has, and it's garnered national attention as well. But she was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter in a jury-waived trial. And the judge sentenced her to 2.5 years with 15 months to serve and the rest suspended on 5 years probation. But he also stayed her sentence because the defense is going to prepare an appeal. And the logic is that by the time the appeal comes, the 15 months would be over. So the judge has agreed to that, but also questioned the defense attorney as to whether if the appeal were denied at the state level, whether there'd be a pursuit at the federal level. And the defense attorney said, yes, there would be, certainly. And the judge said, well, you couldn't count on a stay beyond the state appeal process. The prosecution had asked for 7 to 12 years, and by statute, she could have been sentenced to 20. But a lot of local retired judges here, including the juvenile court judge that made the initial determination that there was probable cause to move forward, were quoted in our newspaper yesterday. So they made these quotes on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. That they thought that rehabilitation would be far preferable to incarceration for Michelle Carter. Taken into consideration the significant mental health issues involved with both Conrad Roy, the young man who committed suicide 3 years ago, and Miss Carter. The family, of course, was looking for more than that, and they were disappointed with the sentence. It's interesting, the fiancé of a relative of Mr. Roy, mm-hmm. described Ms. Carter as a bully. I don't think either these judges that we talked with and a retired district attorney and apparently Judge Moniz who oversaw this trial. I don't believe they saw it that way. And we've received letters from readers who have considered that it was a bullying issue as well. But it appears that the court didn't see it that way.
I know that Judge Moniz, he stated that he thought it was a tragedy for two families here, for both of them.
Indeed. And also, even those who suggested that perhaps incarceration wasn't the right answer. To a person, all expect that she must be held responsible. Mm-hmm. It's just I hate to even use the word fascinating because it takes away from the, I think it might take away from the tragedy of it, but I think it's very significant because it has brought attention to mental health in general and suicide in particular, mm-hmm. and the intersection with electronic social media, which, you know, Twitter and Facebook are only less than a decade old, and doesn't it feel like they've been here forever?
I'm sure that's part of the reason why the story had such legs going national, too, that it is the intersection, as you say, of a number of different issues that are still out there and are yet to be worked towards any kind of resolution.
Indeed. I don't think those legs have worn out by any means.
Jim DiRuta of New Bedford Standard Times, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
And this is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to go to a break. When we come back in the next segment, we'll hear from Josh Bolling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. With me is Jeff Spillane. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker, and joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. Jeff, the concerns about a local wellness program after its operating budget was left out of state funding. This program provides, there are concerns about the programs it provides to the community going away, but also concerns about the jobs that might be lost.
Yeah, definitely, Steve. This is a program called the Prevention and Wellness Trust Fund. It began back in 2012. It was through the state of Massachusetts. And between the years 2014 and 2017, the Barnstable County has received $4.2 million in funding for this program through community partnerships. And what it does is this program has been designed to provide counseling and preventive education to help people before they would end up in a hospital. For instance, how do you treat diabetes? How do you avoid becoming a diabetic? How do you deal with hypertension? And one here on the Cape that's been particularly successful, by all indications, is how to help the elderly from preventing falls in mm-hmm. their homes. This program, as you had mentioned, did not make it into the fiscal year 2018 budget. It did not make it out of the conference. And then as of June 30th, it is out of money. This program here in Barnstable County is coordinated by the county in partnership with several health centers, such as the Duffy Health Center in Hyannis, the Community Health Center at Cape Cod in Mashpee. And there are 29 jobs directly related to this trust fund funding. Anything from physical therapists to counselors that go into homes. And as Senator Julian Sear said on Wednesday at a press conference, this is a first-of-its-kind program in the nation, and it's for funding health prevention.
And a successful program, it sounds
successful.
Like, by most any measure.
That's right. There was a study from Harvard that said it was very successful here in Barnstable County and in the state as well. So the legislators got together on Wednesday at the YMCA in West Barnstable and said they are vowing to save this program because it does save lives and cuts down on health care costs.
But where are they going to
things in the bun?
Where do they find the money for this?
And therein lies the problem, Steve. It'd be interesting to find out where they go next. And, you know, it was Senator Sear, it was Representative Whalen, Hunt, Crocker, were all there on Wednesday. They really want to save these educational programs, these home health visits that help people here on the Cape stay healthy and out of the hospital. And it's unfortunate that the money is gone, but also if this money is not funded and the program reauthorized, these 29 jobs that is created here on the Cape could be gone by the end of the year.
Mm. On the phone now is Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, you have an update on this proposal to combat Lyme disease with genetically modified mice. Tell us about this.
Yes, this is a story and a proposal that began back in the fall and the winter. An MIT scientist and his team have proposed using genetically modified mice to combat not only Lyme but other tick-borne diseases. Basically, what they're doing is they're looking to isolate Lyme immune genes in white-footed mice in the hopes of inserting that gene into other mice and then breeding them by the hundreds of thousands and releasing them on Nantucket and other places where Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases are prevalent in an attempt to slow and perhaps even stop the disease. They're moving forward, but they say they're not going to do anything really without the full support of the community. They're very careful, being very careful to say we're not going to do this without the go-ahead. And the town's Board of Health is fully on board with that as well. Before anything happens, years down the road, there'll have to be a town meeting vote. They've also set up a steering committee that includes a number of scientists, a number of doctors, as well as one person who they described as and describes herself as a skeptic. To continue asking questions about this, obviously there are a lot of questions and concerns about any time you bring up phrases like genetically modified. But the plan in and of itself is fairly simple. Like I said, they want to introduce these mice onto the island in the hopes that if a tick bites one of these mice, they will not transfer Lyme to humans or any other animals. And they're also looking as a next step potentially to turning the mice themselves into sort of walking pesticides, that if a tick bites the mouse, that tick will die, and it wouldn't go any further to any other animal, any human at all. So the first step after success, if they have it, is to introduce these mice onto uninhabited islands and see how that works. And after that, which could be 3 or 4 years down the road, they would come to the town, present their case, and see if Nantucket is in favor of releasing genetically modified mice as an attempt to combat Lyme. And Nantucket has arguably the highest incidence of Lyme disease in the country. Several hundred cases of Lyme are diagnosed every year, and that doesn't take into account, doctors and scientists say, the number of visitors who contract Lyme here and go home and then either don't realize they have it or don't know where they got it.
Sure. It seems like a radical approach, but you haven't heard that many other options put forward for this.
Exactly. A radical approach, a sort of 21st century, maybe even science fiction approach, but incredible things are happening in science and genetics now, and if they can prove and convince the community that there aren't going to be any unintended consequences, it may be a way to address the Lyme and tick-borne disease epidemic that hasn't been addressed so far.
Josh, you have another story, an update on a serial rape case. What's going on here?
We do. A Barnstable Superior Court judge earlier this week denied a motion by the attorney for accused serial rapist David Matterson to hold separate trials in each of the four sexual assaults he's accused of committing between 2008 and 2015. These were cases that really shocked and shook the community, obviously, for almost a decade. Matterson was arrested back in 2015 after a lot of investigative work and following an alleged failed attack in which his DNA was collected and eventually matched to him. The judge, again, said that there cannot be separate trials. There's going to be only one trial, and because of that, Matterson's attorney, Stephen Rohn, said he's looking to seek a plea now. He feels that if he can't try the cases separately, that he doesn't feel a jury would be inclined to find his client innocent, and he is looking for a plea. He would go no further than that in terms of comment, nor would the district attorney's office, but there is another hearing scheduled to come up later this month where these discussions will continue and could, if not bring closure, probably not closure, but at least another step in this process that's been going on for nearly a decade now.
Josh Bolling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I am Steve Junker with Jeff Spillane here. Jeff, medical marijuana still being sorted out very slowly in Sandwich. Selectmen apparently have rejected the idea of a medical marijuana dispensary.
Yeah, they have. And, you know, Steve, five years this November will be it's been 5 years since Massachusetts voted to make medical marijuana legal. There is still no medical marijuana dispensary here on the Cape, and there won't be one in Sandwich for the foreseeable future. Last week, the selectmen in the town voted by 3-2 vote not to allow a medical marijuana dispensary to open up on Route 130, I should say. The company is called In Good Health that was making the proposal for the dispensary. They already operate one in Brockton, about 50 miles from the Cape, and they have 700 patients that travel off Cape to go to that dispensary. So they wanted to open one here closer to their customers. And for the most part, the selectmen who didn't vote for the dispensary were concerned that there was fears of possibility of the drug ending up in the hands of children.
Mm-hmm. So. Although I guess there's tax revenues they're leaving on the table by saying that they don't want this.
They are, yes.
So it's not just one side. And you're pointing out, you're right, there's not even a medical marijuana dispensary on the Cape, or not one on the island, certainly.
No.
This, you know, after so many years after having passed this law.
That's right. And while Sandwich said no last week, I do know that there is a dispensary that is in the process of being built right now in Mashpee, which is very close to the Sandwich line. So, you know, just by maybe a half mile or so, the neighboring town will be getting that tax revenue.
Mental health advocates are expressing some concern about recently privatized emergency psychiatric response services, suggesting that maybe they don't they're not up to the task of really taking over from the state mental health providers with this emergency psychiatric response.
That's right. And as our reporter Cindy McCormick this week phrased it, that there's been some bumps in the road in this program. The National Alliance on Mental Illness has been raising a flag in the past few weeks regarding some emergency psychiatric services that were recently privatized here on the Cape. They were typically state employees who'd respond to these mental health emergencies. They are now employees of a company called Bay Cove, which is out of Boston, now has a Hyannis facility. NAMI, which is National Alliance of Mental Illness, said that this company Bay Cove may have jumped into the Cape not knowing how much work there was to do down here. They're probably understaffed. They don't have enough labor. And they have come up with some points that they've noticed over the past few weeks. For instance, failure to return phone calls to police and family members. This company had said rather than having these mental health emergencies treated in overcrowded emergency rooms where the wait time is very long, we will get to the incident within an hour. That necessarily hasn't been the case, we're finding.
I know the privatization happened in an effort to save money.
Right. Yeah, the state says if we subcontract and privatize this, we're going to save millions of dollars and we're going to divert a lot of these cases from the emergency rooms. And in one particular instance, the Barnstable Police brought it to the attention of the Alliance that they wanted to send a very distraught young man to the hospital. The counselor from Bay Cove said, no, I just send him home. Everything's going to be fine. And he did try to commit suicide that day. So there is some question here as to whether or not they are staffed enough, whether they're prepared to deal with the Cape, and whether they're making the right decisions. And sometimes there's been no response, they're saying.
I saw that they had 536 requests for services in 2 months. That is a lot when you think about that.
Right, 536 calls in 2 months. And that's what's leading this group to say, I don't know if they realized that there was that much of a need and a call for these services on the Cape. And they said it's only compounded by the opioid crisis here as well.
Ed Miller is joining us now from the Provincetown Banner. Hi, Ed.
Good morning.
Ed, Provincetown is going to have a special town meeting to address medical marijuana.
Yes, this seems to be the year for special town meetings in Provincetown called by citizens' petition. There was one earlier this year, you may remember, having to do with the potential taking by eminent domain of the Riley's T-shirt shop in the center of town. This time, it's the potential for medical marijuana facilities to be established on at two different locations on Harry Kemp Way, a busy road, which is nevertheless in a residential district. And the two proposals are for the Gately Funeral Home, which is at one end of the street. And at the other end of the street, there's a law office, Karen DePalma's law office, where another company has proposed a medical marijuana dispensary. The people in the neighborhood are upset about it. They submitted a petition with 215 signatures, and as long as you have over 200, create a required special town meeting, which will now have to be held by September 13th. What they're asking in their petition is that medical marijuana dispensaries not be allowed in the so-called residential 3 and residential B zone. The person who initiated this petition is Stephanie Page. She says that having such a dispensary in that location would cause irreparable and harmful change to our neighborhood, she told the planning board. She says that we do not wish to prohibit medical marijuana completely, but that it should be limited to the general commercial district.
Mm-hmm.
The petition also states that it's not just about the location. It's also based on the assumption that medical dispensaries will evolve into recreational sales facilities when that option is available, which could take place as early as July 1st, 2018, because of a bill that was passed in the state legislature.
Ed, I want to move from marijuana to great white sharks. These continue to be an issue for swimmers on some Provincetown beaches?
Well, yes, there have been a number of sightings. The most recent one was just Monday of this week, where swimmers were advised to stay out of the water at Race Point Beach in Provincetown after a lifeguard spotted a great white shark about 50 yards offshore. There have been several other sightings. On July 23rd, a great white was reported attacking a seal just north of Race Point. On July 9th, a great white was spotted just south of Race Point, measuring between 8 and 10 feet. And there have been four other sightings in the Provincetown area in July, according to the Sharktivity app, which tracks tagged sharks and reports sightings. So there definitely are more sharks out there in the water. Harbormaster Rex McKenzie in Provincetown says, "We knew they were coming up the coast, and this is where they live now." He also notes that there's a different species of shark, the basking shark, which can grow to up to 20 feet long and is often mistaken for a great white, but eats plankton, so they're not a danger. But the great whites are a cause for concern, and the advice from the experts is don't swim at sunrise or sunset, and don't swim with seals, a really bad idea. Great whites like to come up from below, so they'll come up from deep water right where there's a shelf. At places like Herring Cove Beach or Race Point Beach. There are also fishermen have been seeing them off of Brewster and First Encounter Beach in East Ham, off Billingsgate Shoal at the mouth of Wellfleet Harbor. And there have even been some cases of great whites taking big fish off people's lines from charter boats.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, there's a pretty dramatic photo of the head of a big striper that the rest of it was taken off of a fisherman's line. It's interesting because it hasn't really hurt the charter fishing business. In fact, people seem to be excited by the idea of actually seeing a shark from the safety of a boat.
Well, shark watches could be the next thing you're running out there.
Might be.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner, thanks for joining us, Ed.
A pleasure. Thank you, Steve.
Okay. This is the Friday News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Jeff Spillane is with us in the studio. There's more in a moment. Welcome back to the News Roundup. On the Point, we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. And Jeff, the Steamship Authority... they had a big accident in June when the high-speed ferry ran into the Hyannis Breakwater. It was an elision, not a collision, because one of the parties was not moving. The jetty was not moving. Now the steamship has put a price on that accident, and it's a big price.
It is. It's a hefty price tag, Steve, and it's not even the final price tag for this accident, which happened on June 16th, the evening of June 16th, when the INO went up on the Breakwater Hyannis port. And at a port council meeting of the Steamship Authority this week, Robert Davis, the new general manager of the Steamship Authority, started to shed a little bit of light on what this is costing. $1.7 million right now. That's $1 million in passenger fares that have been lost during that period when the boat was out of service, $500,000 for parking, $150,000 to rent a charter boat for substitute transportation that during that period, and $50,000 that was paid as a deductible on the insurance policy. And that repair bill is for the insurance is likely to be an issue here because it was a $500,000 repair bill, required a lot of overtime at the shipyard in Fairhaven. So the Steamship Authority gave a little bit of an indication this week that they're expecting the insurance company will likely question that, but the overtime costs there, because they wanted to get the boat back as soon as quick as possible, and it did make it back 3 days earlier than they anticipated. It got back on the 18th of July. 40,000 fewer passengers were carried on that line this
on the charter that they got.
Right.
The $1.7 million, and it's not over yet.
It's not over yet, but they said there's more costs likely to come. Yeah, and we're still waiting for more word on that investigation from the Coast Guard as well.
George Brennan is joining us from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, George.
George, the Obamas are coming to the island.
Yeah, is this really a surprise to anybody? The president, former president, really loved Martha's Vineyard when he was in office. And, you know, it's really no surprise to anybody here that he's coming back. A little bit more difficult to confirm it this time around because, you know, in the past we've been able to get tips, you know, through, you know, him having to make a stop at Joint Base Cape Cod, for example, or, you know, a much bigger Secret Service contingent coming to the island early to prepare things. But he's got a smaller detail this time, doesn't have to make that stop at Joint Base Cape Cod on Air Force One. And so, you know, on a hunch, you know, we were hearing lots of things about the former president coming here. I checked in with the airport manager, and sure enough, she was able to confirm that the Secret Service had been there checking things out. So very interesting, you know, that he's coming back. He's and the family is coming back. They're coming back to one of the same areas that they've been to in the past in Chilmark. And it will be interesting to see if how much we'll see him around, you know, at golf courses and some of the restaurants that they've liked to visit in the past.
And whether it has the same level of impact on island activity, traffic, and everything else.
That's right. You know, people have already mentioned that there won't be that huge motorcade that there was in the past. There won't be, you know, a press bus following along. we won't be getting those interesting updates that we've had in the past from the White House pool, sitting on a bus, haven't seen POTUS all day. You know.
George, you have another story about an island resident from a couple of centuries ago who's still having an impact today, and an impact even in California.
Yeah, this is an interesting story. Lots of people know the legend of Nancy Luce. She was known as the Hen Lady. At her house, which is in at a farm in what is modern West Tisbury, she loved to have lots of chickens running around, and she would name them. And actually, when they would pass away, she would have gravestones with their very interesting names on them. Well, out at the Los Angeles Zoo, a couple of zookeepers have named their new six chickens after the names that were given to the chickens of Nancy Luce here on the island. And there's some interesting names.
What kind of names are we talking about?
Yeah, so you've got names like Levendy Londondy, and you've got names like Tweedledeedle and Labooty Susie, and lots of names that you can't even pronounce.
Yeah.
So they're having some fun with that. One of the zookeepers picked up a book at, you know, just some secondhand shop. It had to do with Nancy Luce. She just loved the story. It's not a completely happy story. Nancy Luce became sort of something that people gawked at on the island. Maybe perhaps the first Martha's Vineyard tourist attraction, even.
Uh-huh.
So interesting story. Yeah. I hope people will give it a read, and it's nice that she's getting some recognition on the West Coast as well.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
Jeff Spillane is with me here in the studio. Jeff, we have a couple of wind power stories to talk about, offshore wind stories. First, I want to talk about Cape Wind, which is the project that wanted to put 130 turbines in Nantucket Sound. It's returning to the news. This project started in 2001. I think a lot of people probably thought this was dead, but the developers say this is not so fast.
That's right. Another breath of life here. Expected today, the Federal Bureau of Ocean Energy will announce a decision that says Cape Wind's lease of 46 acres off Nantucket still remains intact after those, as you had mentioned, back in the early 2000s. And so that we can expect that announcement today. Meanwhile, opponents, primarily the Alliance to Protect Nantucket Sound, are saying, well, you know what? It's been quite a long time here. Things have changed. Technologies have moved along. Perhaps this shouldn't have been approved, as they're anticipating today. The 2009 environmental impact study might need to be updated. Might not be the same as it was 8 years ago.
So that lease is still out there, but there's nothing immediately. They're not moving forward with anything. They still don't have buyers for the electricity.
That's right.
There's still a number of hurdles on that.
Yep.
A separate wind power story. Things are moving forward in an effort to develop offshore wind in an area south of Martha's Vineyard. This is a whole different area from where Cape Wind wants to
it
go.
It is, yes.
And there's a lot of momentum in the state behind putting wind farms out here.
Yes, there is. And this is about 15 to 25 miles south of the vineyard, Steve. There are three companies that are working toward commercial wind farms out there. The company called Bay State Wind seems to have the first mover advantage. It has begun its formal approval to begin its formal analysis of this lease area. Well, construction is several years away. They are out there now to see if they can get the advantage to get the first federally authorized offshore commercial wind farm out there. And what they're doing, they have 187,000 acres of lease submerged land there. With this approval to begin their analysis and testing, they have three moored data gathering buoys that are in place now. And they're going to be collecting data for 2 to 4 years is what they're saying to measure the meteorological events out there, as well as wind conditions, speed, and direction to determine the best way to move forward there.
Now, Eversource is part of this effort.
It is.
With this company. They're working together, and yet Eversource is also on the other side of the equation because they're part of the array of people who are looking at and deciding what's going to go out there.
That's right. That's right.
That's a utility company.
Dong Energy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it's we'll be following that for sure.
We will be. And the other two companies that are looking at this, they say they're not far behind. So there'll be a lot of testing going on out there soon.
In Orleans, there are questions about a plan to restore a pond that really has a beleaguered history.
Yeah, this is Cedar Pond, Steve. It's just south of Route 6. A lot of people may be familiar with Cedar Pond. We've been talking about it for a while now. It's the pond that has the cormorants on the electric lines over. The cormorant guano has really contributed to poor water quality there. Well, now the pond it was a freshwater pond. It's very high salinity. So the group in Orleans, the Conservation Commission, is looking to see what they can do to reduce the saline content in the pond. And they are looking to put in new wear boards there to limit the incoming tides to see if they can restore the pond back to what it was, a freshwater pond. And so once again, you know, we mentioned this pond has been suffering from not only the cormorant waste, there's septic system issues there. And now with the salt water, and one of the Conservation Commission members said, this whole pond is a classic study of everything that man can do wrong to a water system. So hopefully things will get better at Cedar Pond.
Our 2018 political season is officially underway. A little bit hard to believe. A candidate declared this week for the seat currently held by Elizabeth Warren. This is actually the second candidate.
It is the second candidate, second Republican candidate. And yeah, can you believe it? We're 15 months away from the Senate election, but it is underway here in Massachusetts. Republican State Representative Jeff Deal, he represents the area of Whitman, East Bridgewater, and Abington on the South Shore, threw his hat in the ring on Tuesday night in his hometown. The next morning, he kicked off the campaign in downtown Hyannis. And we were there. And Representative Deal, in making his announcement, talked about his platform, obviously. He was the Massachusetts co-chairman of Donald Trump's presidential campaign. So needless to say, his platform is very similar to the president's.
And he says that it could get Massachusetts a seat at the table.
Well, yeah, and he did. He said, when asked about that, do you support President Trump? He said, of course I do. I was the chairman of his campaign, and you know, instead of Senator Warren, as he had said, trying to fight the president and block some of his appointments, you know, I'm on the same page as him, so I can get a seat at the table. And that's what he said. And he did come right off. He started hitting pretty hard against Senator Warren, but the.
Well, I thought it was interesting that Senator Warren, there was a big group of people who turned out just for this announcement to support Senator Warren and push right back.
Well, you know what? It was a larger group, actually, across the street holding Elizabeth Warren signs and some campaign signs, some homemade signs. And for this early in a campaign cycle, to see that type of fervor and that type of participation, all I can say is we need to fasten our seatbelts for this one, because it's going to be a very long and interesting 15 months. Mm-hmm. But her supporters were out in force, and it was very interesting to see that happen so early.
There was some drama among the Barnstable County commissioners this week. Commissioner Ronald Beatty filed a complaint this week against the board on which he serves. It's just a 3-member board. This has to do with what?
Yeah, this is a very unusual one. You know, Ron Beatty, for those of you who may or may not be familiar with him, has a long history of being involved in running for office here on the Cape, known as a watchdog. And has filed in the past a lot of open meeting law complaints against local boards and committees, regional boards as well, Cape Cod Commission. Well, you know, he got elected to sit on the Barnstable County Board of Commissioners in November. And this week he filed another open meeting complaint, except it was against his own board, which is quite unusual. He's claiming that the board violated the open meeting law in regards to a June 28th meeting. He said they didn't have enough specificity in their meeting notes. They didn't have enough information to go into an executive session that day. It just so happens that day is when the Board of Commissioners approved a settlement with the town of Barnstable over a water contamination suit, about a $3 million settlement, which Beatty was against. Mm-hmm. He voted. It was a 2-1 vote. He was against it. So he's asking the Attorney General's office to make any vote taken that day null and void, which could really throw a wrench into this settlement. And I got to tell you, the filing of that complaint has really created tension on the board.
How could it not if there's just three people on that board?
It is, which makes it very difficult that these, you know, one can't talk to another without it being an open meeting violation. It's a quorum. So they can only talk when they meet in informal session. And Leo Cocoon, as the chairman of the board, was, and this is a direct quote from him, said, "I'm beside myself. I try to do everything by the book." And he went as far as to say to me, "This man has no professional ethics." And Beatty turns around and then refers to Mr. Cocoon as cantankerous. Now, next Wednesday could be very interesting because under the law, the board must address this complaint within 14 business days, and they were going to do it on Wednesday. So more drama is likely come Wednesday at the commissioner's meeting.
I want to touch on a story about a young woman from Falmouth. She comes from a family with a long history of public service, and she's following in the path of her brother, who's a police officer who served in Florida and was killed earlier this year.
That's right. And the word that really sticks stuck out to me in this story was the word bittersweet. This is a woman from Falmouth, Caitlin Cotefilo. She's 27 years old. If that name sounds familiar, that's because her brother, John Cotefilo, a 30-year-old deputy sheriff in Hillsborough County in Florida, was killed by a wrong-way driver in the spring of 2016. Actually, he was hailed as a hero because he shielded a civilian car from the oncoming wrong-way driver. Well, his sister has decided to follow in his footsteps. She has undergone training at the Sheriff's Academy in Florida and recently joined the Hillsborough, Florida Sheriff's Office.
And she kind of she was thinking she was going to go into the Coast Guard.
That's right.
And she went down there to visit after her brother was killed and really was so impressed by the work that was happening.
She didn't want to move to Florida initially, but then she said, you know, when I saw what he did and his legacy there, and she said, this is for me. And as you mentioned, her family, long legacy of law enforcement, father, grandfather, brother.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Thanks, Jeff, for being here.
You're welcome, Steve.
And thanks to our other contributors, Jim DiArruda from the New Bedford Standard Times, Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you for listening. I'm Steve Junker.
The Friday News Roundup is produced by Steve Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.